Recursion is a problem solution technique. It's actually a set of techniques, which is sort of the inverse of the way you've probably been solving most problems already. Most solutions are iterative solutions that you've been doing up to this point, which means that basically you solve a problem in a set of deductive steps, solving part of the problem, the next part, etc. In recursion, you do it inductively. That's kind of it's different from deduction. In terms of an example of inductive reasoning, if I ask you, for example, to tell me what's the largest integer that might result from adding 2 1-million digit integers. Now you might think that's a pretty tough question to answer. But it's not if you attack it inductively. If you attack it inductively, that seemingly difficult question is actually quite trivial. And the way you attack it inductively is you don't actually start with that problem. You think about the very simplest form of the problem. Well, the very simplest form of trying to reason about the sum of 2 1-million digit integers, the simplest would be trying to reason about the sum of 2 1-digit integers. What's the largest sum that could result from adding 2 1-digit integers? 18, which is a 2-digit integer. What's the largest sum that could result from adding 2 2-digit integers? 198, which is a... Now, let me ask you that question again. What's the largest sum that can result from adding 2 1-million digit integers? It's 1,000,001-digit integer. Okay? That's inductive reasoning, where you reason from the very simplest form of the problem up to the general form of the problem and generalize it. Not quite the same as deductive reasoning. That's really the heart of recursion, is that type of thinking applied to problem solving. It's really just a different form of problem solving than you've already been used to doing. Whereas most iterative problem solutions, you solve something by doing a bunch of steps in a loop. In recursion, you replace that loop essentially with function calls to solve a simpler form of the problem, and then you break that down into an even simpler form, a simpler form, and you just keep calling it recursively with simpler and simpler versions of the problem until you get to a very simple version that you know the solution for. And then from that simple version, you build back up to the general version. That's sort of the outline of recursive thinking. Recursion occurs in a lot of places besides programming. It occurs in mathematics a lot. You have recurrence relations, recursive functions, functions that are defined in terms of themselves. It occurs in music, art. There's a well-known computer scientist by the name of Douglas Hofstadter. He wrote a book called Gödel, Escher, and Bach, The Eternal Golden Brain. Won the Pulitzer Prize for it, if I'm not mistaken. And he basically shows throughout that book all of the recursive themes that underlies these three persons' works. Kurt Gödel was a mathematician, Bach, of course, was a composer, and Escher, M.C. Escher, was an artist. Up there is one of M.C. Escher's drawings. His drawings were a lot of times very sort of introverted, aggressive type drawings where they were drawings about drawings or things about things going in circles. You may have seen the one where the waterfall looks like it's falling around in a circle, or stairs that look like they're going around in a circle going up and down. Here's one that I particularly like where he's got these two hands that are sort of drawing themselves into existence. And of course it begs the question of which one would have started first. Hofstetter played around with recursion a lot in his book, and he came up with a lot of recursive postulates, one of which he applied to programming here, Hofstetter's law. He said in terms of programming, it always takes longer than you expect, even when you take into account Hofstetter's law. Even when you take into account that it's going to take longer than you expect, it will still take longer than you expect, even if you take in, well, never mind. Bach, of course, if you listen to a lot of Bach's music, and you can hear the recursive themes in his music. Kurt Gödel, he actually was a mathematician who developed theorems about theorems. Theorems about problem solving. Theorems about axiom systems. He proved that in a fairly powerful axiom system. In an axiom system of a certain power, and he defined what that would be, basically the real numbers qualifies, some simpler ones don't. But he basically proved that in a fairly powerful logical axiom system of thought, that there will be statements that you can make in that system that you will never be able to prove, or you will never be able to decide whether they are true or false. That for mathematicians was a real shocker. It really destroyed a lot of the beauty of mathematics for a lot of people, because everybody sort of thought, you know, if you can make a logical statement in mathematics that somehow, some way, you can either, they didn't care whether you could always prove it true, but at least whether you could prove it true or false, one of the two. And he proved, unfortunately, that for some statements, you can't do either. Gödel's undecidability, or his incompleteness theorem, I think is what it's usually referred to. Not like reading. I have a friend who teaches English at a college, and I was talking to him one day about recursion, and I used a fairly large word, and he went, "Oh, you're a sesquipedalian." I went, "What's a sesquipedalian?" And he said, "Well, that's someone who uses words like sesquipedalian, someone who uses large words." He was being cute in defining it in terms of itself, which is recursive. And of course, if you know a little bit about baseball, one of Yogi Berra's famous recursive quotes is "Deja vu all over again." So let's look here on the next slide, on slide 9.3, and here's a little simple example of a recursive function to compute factorials, which probably a lot of you've seen. If you want to compute n factorial, which is just the products from 1 to n, of the integers from 1 to n, you can do it with a simple little loop. That's shown up at the top. Now that's a straightforward iterative solution. You can also do it recursively. You can write a recursive function called factorial down there at the bottom, which will essentially compute the same number, the same result, as the iterative version up at the top. Now, if you look at this, this says, okay, if n is greater than 1, then return n times, and it calls itself recursively factorial of n minus 1. So it calls itself again. That's the gist of recursive function. is inside the function, you have a call to the function. And what you have to do when you call it recursively is simplify the problem. And this is simplifying the problem. Because if we reduce n, eventually, assuming that n is positive, n will eventually become 1, and 1 times 1 factorial is just 1. And so we can return 1, and that'll stop the recursive call. So here on the next slide is a simple little trace of this recursive function for factorial sub 5. Factorial sub 5, that checks that n, which is 5, is greater than 1, so that's 5 times factorial of n minus 1, which is factorial of 4. That factorial 4 calls itself recursively, so it executes. 4 is greater than 1, so that's 4 times factorial n minus 1, which is factorial 3, which that one basically executes, essentially having a new version of the function. That executes factorial of 3 executes, which results in factorial of 2 executing, which results in a call to factorial of 1. Now when factorial of 1 executes, it checks n is not greater than 1 for that execution, so it returns 1. That gets plugged in to the recursive call. So that's 2 times 1, the value that was returned, that's 2, and that's returned up here. That's plugged in for factorial of 2. Well, 3 times 2 is 6. That gets returned, plugged in for factorial of 3. 4 times 6, 24, gets returned for factorial of 4. 5 times 24 is 120, and that gets returned back into the main program or whatever calls factorial of 5. As you're making the recursive calls, that's usually sometimes referred to as the recursive descent. Okay, as you simplify the problem down to a version that you have programmed up a solution for. And then once that solves it, quite often that returns values up and you have the return sequence taking place. And you may or may not do work going down, and you may or may not do work going up. It just depends upon the problem that you're solving. So here on the next slide, we can see some of the common attributes that recursive functions have. Every recursive algorithm can be implemented non-recursively. Essentially, there is a proof from computability theory. Bohm, Jacobini, and I forget the third guy's name, they basically came up with a proof in the area of computability theory, which is sort of the theory of computable numbers, which I did some of my graduate work on in. They came up with a proof, and they proved that any problem that can be solved iteratively can also be solved recursively, and vice versa. They're basically inverse processes. Eventually, when you're doing recursion, the routine has to stop calling itself so that it can back out. If it doesn't, and it gets into an infinite regressive or recursive call, that's essentially the equivalent of an infinite loop in iterative programming, which you have to be careful of. And you've got to be a little bit careful sometimes with recursive functions for that factorial implementation. It doesn't take into account negative numbers. We could modify it quite simply to stop the very first time if there's a negative number being passed in. But you have to just be a little bit careful about that. The big thing that you should always remember about recursion is that it's inefficient. It's quite inefficient in terms of its execution because of all of the overhead that's involved with calling, making multiple calls to a function. And we're going to look into that a little bit in terms of this inefficiency. But before we do that, we want to look at some more examples of recursion. Here on slide 9.6 is a little sample program, a sample recursive function that sums up an array, but it does it recursively. Now it sums up an array of integers named int, x, and it goes from the indexes from start to stop. So it actually will sum up a subset, if you want to, of the array. And you can call it with an array, the starting index, the ending index, and it'll sum it up. The way it does this, now, first you have to decide upon what are the simple forms of the problem for which we can know an answer or compute an answer directly without recursion. One of those is some error checking here. If starts is greater than stop, if they've given us an invalid range, okay, they've given us an invalid range to sum up, or if starts or stop are illegal indexes, if they're less than zero. If that's the case, we'll return zero to indicate that we can't sum up anything. Otherwise, we'll check if start is equal to stop. Now, think about it. If they've asked us to sum up a subset of the array where the subset is from this index to the same index, what's the sum of that? It's the value that's in there. Okay? Now, that seems trivial, but it's what we're really going to use as the basis for our solution. Because we're essentially going to, now what we're going to do is redefine the problem in terms of simpler versions of itself to where eventually we reduce the problem to this base case. And what we do here then, otherwise if start and stop are valid ranges, they're a valid range and they're not equal to each other, then we'll set our we'll return x sub start plus, now, what we're going to do at that point is then say that the sum from start to stop is the sum of the first one plus the sum of the rest of the array. Now, do we have a function to compute the sum of the rest of the array? Yes, we do. It's the function we're writing. Okay? That's where most people have their problem when trying to solve something recursively. They don't realize that when they're decomposing the problem, that they have to try and decompose it into a simpler form of itself so that they can use the same function that they're coding, even if they haven't finished the coding. Okay? So what we can do here is we can say the sum then is x start plus the sum of the array, calling it recursively, of x from start plus 1 to stop. So we'll move to the next index past start, and we'll call it recursively for the rest of it. Now, on the next slide, you can see a trace of this. Here's a simple trace of this. If we're given this x sub 5 array with these 5 values inside of it, and we call some array from 0 to 4, okay? Stop has to be the last valid index, so we don't pass in 5 because 5 isn't a valid index. We want to sum up the array from indexes 0 to 4. And so what we get then the first time, 0 is less than 4, they're not equal. So that returns x sub 0 plus some array x 1 to 4. Well, that makes a recursive call. That makes a recursive call from 1 to 4. Well, that returns x1 plus sum of x 2 4. So that has some array to sum up 2 to 4, which results in x sub 2 plus the sum of the array from 3 to 4, which results in x sub 3 plus the sum of the array from 4 to 4. Now this last recursive call here, start and stop are equal to each other. So that just returns x sub 4, which is 19. That gets plugged into here. It adds the x sub 3 and 19, 42 and 19, which is 61. That gets returned up to here. That gets added with x sub 2, which is 22. That's 83. And you can see how it just works its way back up at that point. Questions? Anybody got any questions on how that works?
I feel like going down, coming back up, is that how I put it? I don't know if it is.
The compiler doesn't do it. The compiler doesn't execute code. The compiler translates your function to make it reentrant code, and builds and creates an activation template record for the function, which then, with the runtime mechanism for the recursive calls, keeps generating activation records, which gets placed on the runtime stack, re-executing the program, re-executing the function with different values of its local variables. Now, we're going to actually delve into that a little bit more later on, so you'll be able to understand it a little bit better. Okay? But I can't really explain it without using some terminology like that.
Okay.
Okay.
What I was going to ask you is, rather than coming up some problems, actually
do it that way? Yes, the execution actually does it that way. Yes, it does. It does not somehow morph it into iterative code, if that's what you were thinking. No.
I'm thinking it might keep like, say, n equals some array at 0 to 4, keep a running total of an n.
No, it can't keep a running total because that would mean that it could somehow compute ahead to know that that it's only going to have sort of one thing to do on, after each return, and it just can't figure that out ahead of time. All right. Now we're going to get into some more complicated applications of recursion. Here on slide 9.8 is an example of tail recursion. We're going to look at about four or five examples of applying recursion to problem solving, sort of patterns of recursive problem solving. And if you can understand these four or five patterns of recursive problem solving, you'll be able to get a good handle on recursion. It won't be the most complicated thing you see or ever do with recursion, but it'll give you a good start. Question?
Yeah.
Where? Here?
Yes.
That would cause an error.
Yeah, because head doesn't exist.
Because head doesn't exist. Gee, I could have swore that in linked list that there was head, tail, and cur in the linked list class. And this is a member of the linked list class according to the scope resolution operator here. Agreed? Okay. This is an example of what's called tail recursion, or sometimes referred to as going up recursion. It's really a very simple form of recursion. If we wanted in our linked list class to include in that class a size list function that would return back how many elements are in the list, how many things are stored in the list. We could do it recursively like the following. We could say, for example, well, the base case, the simplest case, would be if the list was empty. If the list was empty, the size would be zero. In the general case, for some arbitrary length list, We can always check to see if the first node exists. If the first node doesn't exist, we know the list is empty, right? And we know what the solution is. But if the first node does exist, we know there's at least one node, and the size of the list then is that one node, 1, plus the size of the rest of the list. Well, the size of the rest of the list is really just a bunch of nodes, and a bunch of nodes connected together is really just a linked list. And we have a function that computes the size of a linked list. Yeah, it's the one we're writing at the moment. So we can solve it recursively. So what we can do here then is we'll start off when somebody invokes our size list function on a list. We'll call an internal private function that'll actually do the recursion called list size. And it accepts a pointer to a node. And we'll pass it head to start with. Our base case, we check to see if list is equal to null. If that head node is pointer is equal to null, we'll return 0. Otherwise, we know the list isn't empty, so we can return 1 plus the size of the rest of the list. And so what we need to do then is call this recursively with the pointer to the next node. And we can just tell this node object to give us a pointer to its next node, which we'll then pass in recursively. So you can see down here for this simple list down at the bottom, here's a trace of this thing recursively. Starting out, if we've got these numbers on the list, then we would look, the first one, the list isn't empty, so that's 1 plus the size of the rest of the list. And that list isn't empty, so that's 1 plus the size of the rest of the list, which isn't empty, 1 plus the size, 1 plus. Eventually we get down to an empty list, which is 0, and allows it to back itself out. Now, you could trace that up with the pointers and with the linked list code if you wish. You'll arrive at the same results here. Now, the simple thing about tail recursion is that you start whatever data you're working with. It doesn't have to be a list. It can be any data. Whatever data there is that you're working with, tail recursive programs are sort of characterized by you first look at the very first part of your data, the beginning of your data, and you see if that yields you a solution, like one of your simple base case solutions. And if it doesn't, then you think, well, what work can I do on this simple data to reduce the problem in simpler terms? And you do that work, and then you call the function recursively with the rest of the data. And that's just what this does. Okay? That's the problem-solving pattern of tail recursion. Now, one other sort of characteristic of it is that you can almost easily remove tail recursion by replacing the recursive call, which will almost always be at the end of your function, with a simple loop. Tail recursion is really very inefficient, and you hardly ever wish to use it. As a problem solution technique, it's not a very efficient technique, and it's so easy to replace that you really shouldn't use it. Now, let's look here on slide 9.9 at a little bit more of a complex problem that uses it sort of uses the inverse form of tail recursion, sometimes referred to as head recursion. I've actually given this problem on test before. It seems so simple. Write a function which takes an integer and outputs it with commas in the appropriate places, not using strings, and do it recursively. That actually gets to be a little bit tricky. However, if you think about it inductively, it's not so complicated. What's the simplest case of an integer where you would need to do the minimum amount of work in terms of outputting it with commas? Yeah, if it was less than 1,000 and you didn't have any commas to output. So that's your base case. If basically I don't have to do any work. If it's less than 1,000, I can just print out or display the number and I'm done. Otherwise, if it's greater than 1,000, Now think about the part that's greater than 1,000. If that was already done, what would I need to do? Just print out a comma and this part below 1,000. Well, that number that's above 1,000 is really just an integer too. And so do I have a function that outputs an integer with commas? Yes, it's the function I'm writing, even though I haven't finished writing it. So I can call it recursively. Now, here's the solution. If we just want to output this on the screen to see out, if the num is less than 1,000, we'll set a field width of 3, we'll output the number. Otherwise, we'll divide the number by 1,000 and call it recursively. That'll output the digits above 1,000 with commas. Then we can output our comma, and we can output num mod 1,000, the 3 digits below 1,000. Now, for this first number here, That comes out just like what you would think, right? What about for the second number here? 1,001. What does 1,001 output? Huh? 1, he said 1,001. Unfortunately, I beg to differ. 1,001. Because when it would, it's 1,001 greater than 1,000, so the else will execute. It'll call itself recursively, for 1,001 divided by 1,000 is 1. That'll output a 1. Then that recursive call will complete, and this one will pick back up. Then it will output a comma, and then 1,001 mod 1,000 is 1. Okay? So, actually, to be honest with you, when I gave this problem on the test, anybody who got that, and look how simple that is. I mean, it's only about, what, 4 lines of code. I gave them full credit for the problem if they put that. I gave people a bonus if they actually realized that they had to take into account those leading zeros, which is a little tricky to realize. You can miss that.
I know it's that, would that be 1,001?
Yeah, it would actually print out 1,001 to be exact. Okay? So to print out 1,001, the version on the previous slide. Yeah, you could use a set field to zero, but you could do that. You could use set field to zero, and that would work okay. I prefer to use numeric. When I'm doing numeric computation things like this, I try to go ahead and do it numerically if I can. And you can. Here's a version of it where after I call it with the number greater than 1,000 and output the comma, then I'll just compute the digits here separately. I'll multiply 1,000, and then I'll output the hundredth digit by dividing that by 100. Then I'll mod that by 100, and I'll output the tens digit, and then finally the ones digit. So I'll just output the digits separately. You could do it like that. You could also do it like this if you wanted to, where you could actually sort of use a string and use the ternary operator to set the correct prefix, or you could do set field. There's several other ways you could do this. And here's an example of the recursion going on. The difference between this and tail recursion, that's what I really want you to see, is the difference in the problem solution pattern, in the application of recursion to the problem. For the big difference, and there's not really a huge difference, here we do our recursive call, and then we have some more work to do. Whereas with the tail recursion, sort of the last, we did our work first, and then we did the recursive call to do the rest of the work. So here we're sort of doing our work as we're coming back up the recursion, or as we're I don't really like these two terms of tail recursion and head recursion. In tail recursion, by the time you've reached the tail, you've basically done all your work. And in this one, this is sort of just the opposite. When you reach the tail, you've really just started your work, because you do all your work sort of as you're coming back up. But that's the terms that have been developed for these two problem solution techniques. But there's not much difference in them. You can either think about it, it doesn't really matter too much which way you do it. You'll use these techniques, you'll use both of these two techniques on different problems. These aren't really the more powerful recursive problem solution techniques. Let's look at a few others here. We probably may only have time to talk about a couple more today, but we'll see. So, we said, to just sort of sum up here before we go on, in tail recursion, We start with the beginning data, the first part of the data that we're working with. We do our work, and then we call it recursively for the rest of the data. In head recursion, we break it up into the, we pull off the first part, and we call it recursively for the rest part, for the rest of the data. And we keep doing that until we really sort of get at the end of the data. And then as we're coming back up, we do our work. So that's sort of head recursion. Now we're going to look at what's called middle decomposition. In middle decomposition, the problem solution pattern, in a sense, is to sort of divide the data up into two halves and solve it for the first half, solve it for the second half, and then apply those two solutions to the middle part of the data. Okay? So we divide the data up into a lower half, an upper half, and maybe a middle piece of the data. We solve it recursively for the upper and lower half, and then we check to see how that solution compares to the middle part of the data. So here's our problem. Given an array of integers, some n plus 1 elements, whatever, the size really doesn't matter too much here, code a function that returns the index of the maximum value in the array. Basically, this is sort of a max function. But instead of returning the maximum value in an array, it's returning where it's at, the index. You could code this up trivially, I would hope, iteratively, right? With a loop. This is trivial to do with a loop. It's a little tough to do recursively. But remember, everything that can be done iteratively can also be done recursively. So what we do here, applying middle decomposition to this problem, is we'll check to see if the middle element is the largest. And if so, we'll return its index. Now, most of the time you wouldn't even think of that as a solution. Because you're thinking, how can I just look at the middle item and say, okay, if that's the largest, then it's the solution. Well, you can only do that, of course, if you at first know the largest index, or the index of the largest one in the lower half, and the index of the largest one in the upper half, so that you can compare the three. And if you think about it that way, then you have to sort of ask yourself the question, so if I need to find the index in a subset of the array in the lower half. Now, do I have a function that'll do that? Surprise, surprise, it's the one I'm writing. Okay? So we basically just call this thing recursively on the lower half and the upper half. Now, this gets a little bit messy here because of we might, if we're not careful, run into some unknown value. Now, you'll see here in a moment. So what we do here, let's look at this code. We've got our array, which we're passing in by constant reference. We've got start and end, which is the subset of the array that we're looking for the largest value in. Those are being passed by value. Now, that's actually important, how you pass the parameters in by reference or by value is actually of paramount importance to recursion. We'll talk a little bit more about that later on, but just keep it in mind at the moment. And then we, of course, we'll just define some constant here, unknown, and we'll check if end is less than start. If somehow this has been called for an invalid subset of the array, if it's been called for an invalid subset, we'll return unknown. Right? We'll return a negative 1 index because we can't have a largest value in an invalid subset. Then what we'll do otherwise, we know that either end and start are equal or that start is less than end. So what we'll do here is we'll compute the middle index, start plus end divided by 2. And from that middle index, we will then need to find out the maximum index or the index of the maximum value in the first half, in half one. So we'll set H1 max, which is the index of the largest value in the first half, equal to, and we'll call this recursively, R max ray of start to mid minus 1. That's the left half. And we'll check here, though, when that comes back, if that's equal to unknown, then we accidentally then asked it to compute the largest index for an invalid subset. And so if that's the case, we'll just set H1 max to start to make it a valid index. Otherwise, we'll do the same thing for the right half here, mid plus 1 to end. Okay, that's the upper half. And we'll check once again to see if we accidentally asked that one to, if we asked it to find the largest value of an invalid in subset of the array, and if so, we'll set that to end. And now we can do our comparison. If ray sub mid is greater than ray sub H1 max, and it's greater than the maximum in the upper half, H2 sub max, then we'll return mid. Otherwise, we'll check if the value of the largest one in the first half is greater than the value of the largest one in the second half, then we'll return the H1 max index. Otherwise, we'll return the H2 max index. Right? There's that ternary operator, which is just a simple if statement form. Right? Now, let's look at I think there's a trace here. Yeah. Here's a trace. Now, this is an example of a tree trace call, which is quite common in recursive programming, that when you have multiple recursive calls from the function to itself, a lot of times it'll be easier to trace it if you do it in sort of a tree layout like this. So here's a simple little array of 5 elements, and we call it recursively from 0 to 4. And it starts out here, it computes 0 and 4 divided by 2 is 2, so it calls it recursively for ray of start and mid minus 1. So that makes this first recursive call over here to the left. Now, then it adds 0 and 1, that's start is less than n, so it adds 0 and 1 and divides by 2, that's 0. Now that makes a recursive call from start to mid minus 1, 0 to minus 1. Now I could have put if statements in the code to prevent these illegal calls, to these calls to these invalid subsets. But I decided instead it would be just as simple to handle it with these unknown values. So in that case I returned unknown. When start is not less than n, I return unknown. And then I checked here, if this came back as unknown, I would set H1 max equal to start, which set it equal to 0. Now then this made the call to the upper half. The upper half was from mid plus 1, which was 1, to n, which is 1. So now we do this recursive call. Ray of 1, 1. Well now, start is not less than n, so that's a valid subset. So it computes the midpoint. Start plus 1, n plus 1 by 2, 1 plus 1 divided by 2 is 1. So now we call it for the lower half, which is start to mid minus 1, 1 to 0. That's an invalid range. That recursive call returns unknown, which would set H1 max equal to start here. Then we call it for the upper half, which would be mid plus 1, which is 2, to end, which is 1. That's also invalid. Start is not less than end. So that would return unknown. And we then check to see if that comes back as unknown, and if so, we set H2 max equal to end. Now here we compare to see if ray sub mid, which is 1, is greater than ray sub H1 max, which is 1, and also if it's greater than H2 max, which is 1. So we're doing a lot of extra work here, checking to see if a value is greater than itself twice. Okay? It really doesn't matter at that point. It won't be greater than itself twice. Eventually what will happen here, if you look at that previous code and execute it here, actually, it does say if it's greater than or equal to both of those. And it is actually greater than or equal to itself. So it would return 1. So that returns 1, and that says H2 max here for this recursive call to 1. So now we compare 0 to 0 to 1. Is this one greater than or equal, is ray sub mid greater than or equal to ray sub H1 max? Well, 56 is greater than or equal to 56. And is ray sub mid or 56 greater than or equal to H2 max, which is 23? That's true. So this returns 0. So we go back up to our original call, and we set its H1 max to 0, which makes sense. Here's the lower half, and this was the largest one. Well, I'm just about out of breath, so I'm not going to talk myself down through the right-hand side of this tree. You can do that one, okay? It's almost identical to the same sort of logical trace as in the left-hand side. But eventually it'll come back with H2 max equal to 4, and that will then compare to see if H max sub mid, which or ray sub mid, which is 2, is greater than ray sub H1 max, which is 56, which it's not. So that's going to make that first if statement false. It'll go down to the second return, and it'll check to see if H1 max is greater than H2 max, which is false. And it'll make the last return, it'll actually return H2 max in this case, which is 4. Now, think about this. I told you that recursion was inefficient, right? Here's an array of 5 elements. Now, you could do that in a simple little loop that loops from 0 to 4 5 times and be done with it. Look how many recursive calls were made here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 recursive calls to do this recursively. Now, you might begin to wonder, if recursion is so darn inefficient, Mr. Barnett, why are we spending all this time studying it? Okay? Well, yes, it is inefficient. And anything that you can do recursively, you can do iteratively. And you, that might lead you to then think, well, that would mean I don't really need to bother to learn recursion. Anything I can do recursively, I should just be studying iterative problem solution techniques because I know I can solve it iteratively also. And I know that that iterative solution for almost every case, in terms of the theory courses I've taken, I don't think I've ever seen it stated anywhere that every recursive function will be less efficient than a corresponding iterative function. You can't make that blanket generalization. It's most of the time, probably 95% or larger of the time, that is a true statement, however. But the real crux, though, is your own problem solution time, not the execution time of the function. There are certain problems which are very complex. They're quite complex to solve. And trying to solve them iteratively is very, very difficult. However, some of these problems like this will lend themselves to a nice, short, elegant recursive solution. If you think about doing them recursively, you can solve it in a very short amount of time. Whereas if you try and do it iteratively, it might take you several hours to come up with a solution. So then you have to sort of weigh it off. Which is more important, the execution time or my time? Okay? And that's a good question to ask. Now, the answer to that question is depends upon the use of the program. If the use of the program, it's not going to use the recursive function very much. If it's not going to get used very much at all, then you would probably say, well, if it's not going to be used much at all, who cares if that small section of code in the overall program is not quite as efficient as it could be? If it saves me hours and hours of work, so I'll go ahead and do it recursively. We'll also find out, though, that when you ask yourself that question, you also have to ask yourself, though, you know, will this section of code get executed a lot? If this section of code will get executed a lot, then I'm costing all my users quite a bit of their time. which gets multiplied each time that they use this program and this part of the inefficient code. So if that's the case, well, I better go ahead and spend my time to solve this iteratively and save my users gobs of time. Unfortunately, it's a little bit more complicated even than that. It turns out that not only, you might only execute a recursive function maybe once each time a program is run. And you might think, well, if it's only executed once, it doesn't matter if it's inefficient. That's not quite true. It depends upon the data that it's executed upon. If it's executed upon a large amount of data, even though it's only executed once, imagine instead of trying to find recursively the index, the largest index of an array of size 4, what if I have an array of size 1,000 and I try and do it like this? The growth of this tree will not be linear. The growth of this tree will blow up. And it'll get to be huge, and it will really slow the program down. So you have to not only ask yourself if a recursive function will be executed a lot, you also have to check to see whether it will be executed for small amounts of data or large amounts of data. That also affects the decision of whether or not to remove the recursion. There is an algorithm. We do not study it in here because it's a little bit beyond this course. You haven't learned everything you need to yet in order to be able to do it. But there is an algorithm that allows you, that you can go through to convert any recursive code into iterative code. And that's really powerful because then you can solve something iteratively. And then you can just plug and chug this code through it. You can solve something recursively, which might take a long time iteratively to solve. And then you just apply this algorithm. And you come out of the algorithm with a nice iterative solution. It may not be an optimal iterative solution, but it will almost always be an iterative solution that will be a lot faster than the corresponding recursive solution. And you'll learn that algorithm a little bit later on. Now, there's another recursive problem solution pattern that we want to look at called edges and center decomposition. There's this one and one more. There's about five patterns we're going to look at. We've looked at tail recursion, head recursion, middle decomposition, and this is called edges and center decomposition. In edges and center decomposition, what you do is you take the data that you're working with and you pull the data off of the ends. And you say, can I do something to solve the problem or work with the ends to get it solved at both ends? And then if I can, then what about the rest of the data? Most of the time you'll find if you can do that, that you can call this recursively on the center, working your way towards the center on the rest of the data. So here's one. This is a classic sorting problem. Let's say we want to sort an array of integers into ascending order. You know how to do this iteratively. You actually even know the algorithm I'm going to modify and use. The selection sort algorithm, if you're doing it iteratively, says you go through and find like the smallest one and you swap it with the one at the beginning, right? Well now, as you're going through an array and finding the smallest one, at the same time, you can also find the largest one. Did you?
Yeah.
So what you can do, then you know the collision problem you have to be careful about?
I was sorting strings.
Now we'll see. It doesn't matter what you're sorting. If they're all unique, you're okay, sort of.
Yeah.
But what you do is you go through the array, you find the largest and smallest one, and you swap the smallest one at the beginning and the largest one at the end. And then now you've got another subset of the array to sort, and do you have a function to do that? Sure, it's the one you're coding up right now. Okay? So that's basically the edges and center decomposition pattern. You solve the problem for the end data, and then you solve it for the rest of the data, doing it the same way, working your way towards the middle, at which point you're done, towards the center. So you can see for this one, we go through here. We would go through the first time. We'd find the smallest one, which is 17. We'd swap it with the first one. We'd also at the same time find the largest one, and we'd swap it with the end one. So now the edges are done, and we just need to sort the rest of the array the same way. Okay? So here's the code to do this. I sort of named this thing the duplex selection sort. So it's sort of doing a selection sort, but in duplex. So here's what we've got our array, and we want to sort it from start to end. So I'll set some other indexes here. Mini and maxi to start and end. I'll check if start is less than end. We know we've got a valid subset to sort, right? So if start is less than end, then first I'll find the minimum and the maximum index. For this subset of the array from start to end, I'll find where the minimum one, the index of the minimum, and the index of the maximum. And then I'll swap those edges. And once I've swapped those edges, then I can just call this recursively for start plus 1 to end minus 1, working my way into the middle. Okay? Now, the find mini and maxi here, find mini and maxi, you can look at that code. Is that code, find mini and maxi, an example of edges and center decomposition? It's recursive. It's calling itself recursively. Is it an example of edges and center decomposition? This is trivial. Somebody be brave. No. What of the other three types that we've studied is this an example of? Huh? Tail recursion. Look, the last thing it's doing is calling itself recursively. It first checks to see if it checks to make sure that there is a valid subset, and then it checks the first one. If the first one, start is less than the minimum one found so far, I initialized them up here. If that's true, then I'll reset the minimum index to the start index. If that's false, I'll check to see if this one is greater than the largest one so far. And if that's true, I'll reset the maximum index. Now, I've got this as an else because there's no way one value can be larger than the largest one and smaller than the smallest one. Those are mutually exclusive if statements. And then I just call it recursively here with start plus 1. So first it compares the start element to both the smallest and largest one. Then it compares the next one, and works its way to the end. That's just tail recursion. I could do that with a little simple loop, but since I was doing this thing recursively, I decided in the spirit of recursion, I would do this one recursively too. Now, the swap edges down here gets a little tricky. It turns out that you have to be careful. You can't just arbitrarily swap the smallest one with the first one and the largest one at the end. Because what happens if the array is in the opposite sorted order that you want it in? Instead of in ascending order from smallest to largest, let's say it's in descending order. It's in largest to smallest order. And we call it recursive, and we try and sort it like this. If that's true, then when find, mini, and maxi comes back, where will the largest one be? It'll be at the start position. And where will the minimum one be? At the end. And so then if I swap mini and start, and then I swap maxi and end, what will I have ended up doing? Huh? I'll have the exact same thing I started out with, because they will be on the end, and I'll swap them once, and then I'll swap them again. And I will have shot myself in the foot. Okay? So I have to check for this possibility of swap interference. Did you check for that? It only comes about, it comes about in a couple places. You can have double interference, which is where mini is equal to end and max is equal to start. If that's the case, you only need to do one swap. Otherwise, you may have interference, but only on one end of the swap. Only one of them may be either the maximum or the largest one might be where you're going to swap one of the others. And so first you can check to see if maxi is equal to start. If that's true, then I'll swap maxi and end first. I'll swap maxi and end first because maxi is where start is going to be. And so I want to move it to the end before I move the minimum one to start. Everybody follow that? Otherwise, mini is equal to end or there's no interference and I can swap them in this order. Okay? And here's a little swap function if you want to use that just for integers. Everybody follow this? Questions on how this works? Now let's look at a little bit more challenging of a problem now. And we also want to look at we're going to look at a few problems where we will look at both iterative and recursive solutions to the same problem, and we will compare those solutions. So here, we're given our link classes that we programmed up previously. And the problem is, if we're given two ordered single linked lists, we want to code a Boolean function, we'll call it sublist, that determines if the first list is a sublist of the second list. Sort of a subset function applied to lists. And we'll define a sublist, L1 is a sublist of L2, if all the elements in the first list are also elements in the second list. That seems obvious. Now, to make this a little bit easier, we'll assume the following. There'll be no duplicate elements in the list, and these are in ascending order, from smallest to largest. We did say they were ordered somehow, so we'll assume ascending order. So here might be a couple lists that we would have. If this is true, we might go to the head of both of those lists, and we would call sublist L1, L2. That would return true. All of the elements in L1 are elements of L2. However, you should be aware that if we call this the sublist L2, L1, that would return false because there are elements in L2 that are not in L1. Okay? So, how would you... I've actually given this problem before on tests. But I didn't ask them to do it recursively. Although, I would argue that it's easier to do this recursively than to do it iteratively. Some might disagree, but I could code this up quicker recursively than I could iteratively. Well, here's an iterative solution, and you can judge which one you think is simpler here. We've got L1 and L2. Now, we're passing these things in by what? By value, which means that for these two objects of this linked list class, as soon as this function is called, what function inside that class will be executed for each of these local objects? The copy constructor. The copy constructor will execute automatically, going down each of the lists, forming a deep copy of the dynamic memory that's in both of these lists, correct? Okay, so we've got two copies that we don't have to worry about destroying the original list because we're working with copies. So we'll go to the head of each of these copies. We'll say, well, there's still a sublist. We'll assume that L1 is a sublist of L2. And then we'll check, while it's still a sublist and we're not at the end of L1, while we're still in the list of L1. We'll check now while we're still in the list of L2 and The current data of L2, that one at the current node, is less than the data that's at the current node in L1. If that's true, then we'll advance L2. We'll move L2 to the next node. And if that's true, we'll just keep going. So we're going to keep going down L2 until either we come to an element that's larger than the current element in L1, or it is equal to it, right? Or until we come to the end of L2. Now once we come out of this loop, then we check. It's still a sublist if we're not in L. It gets a bit complicated here. If we're not at the end of L2, okay? If we're not at the end of L2, it's not L2. Yeah. If we're not in the list, then we know it's not a sublist. We know that there are elements in L1 which can't be in L2 then. We reached the end of L2 and we didn't find the element we're looking for. So in that case, we'll set fill sublist to false. Otherwise, if we're not at the end of L, if we're still in L2, then we'll check to see if the current data in L2, the one we stopped at, is equal to the one in L1. And if those are equal, or regardless, if they're equal, it'll set it to true. And if they're not equal, it'll set still sublist to false. I probably should have done this with an if-then-else statement. This is the same as saying, if not L2 in list, then still sublist equals false. Otherwise, it's equal to this. Then we'll move down L1. And we'll come back up to here while they were still equal and we're not at the end of L1. Basically, all this code is doing, if you think about it a little bit, it's starting out with L1 and L2. It moves down L2 until it either comes to the end of L2 or it comes to an element that's greater than or equal to the one in L1. When it stops, it checks to see if we're at the end, in which case it'll set still sublist to false. But if we're not at the end, then it'll compare these two, the one that we stopped at. And if they're equal, we'll go to the next one in L1 and we'll continue looking for it in L2. And if they're not equal, we'll set still sublist to false and we'll stop. That's basically all it does. It goes down L1, one item at a time, and checks to see if it can find each one of them in L2. Now, recursively, I can sort of state it like this. My base cases. If L1 is empty, I'll return true. Does that make sense? The empty list is a sublist of every other list, sort of like the subset property of mathematics. Otherwise, if L1 is not empty, but L2 is empty, then I'll return false. Okay, L1 is not empty, but L2 is. There's no way that L1 can be a sublist of an empty list. So I'll return false. Otherwise, I'll check here. I'll get the current data. Now, if you'll notice, in order for this one to work, you have to first go to the head of both of these lists so that I'm starting at the beginning of them. This recursive solution assumes that I'm starting at the beginning of them. And then I'll get the current data in L1 and the current data in L2. And if that one in L1 is less than the one in L2, I'll return false. I'm done. There's an item in L1 that is smaller than the current item in L2. Now, these lists are in ascending order, so I know that all of the remaining elements in L2 will be greater than this one. And if this one's smaller than the current one, I'll never be able to find it. So there will be at least one item in L1 that I can't find in L2, so it's not a sublist. Otherwise, I'll check to see if they're equal. If the two current data items are equal that's in those two lists, then I'll advance to the next item in both of those lists, and I'll call it recursively. And it now depends if the remaining elements in L1 are a sublist of the remaining elements in L2. Then I can use my recursive function to compute that. Otherwise, it might be that L1 will be greater than the current data item in L2. So I might still find the current data item in L1, but if I do, it'll be farther down in L2. So what I do here is I'll advance L2 and go to the next one, and I'll call it recursively to see if I can find all of the remaining elements in L1 without advancing it in the remaining elements of L2. Now, this one to me is simpler than this version right here, the code. It depends a little bit upon your thought processes as to which one you might deem to be easier to understand. Once you've done quite a bit of recursive programming, though, you might want to come back to this slide at some point in a year or so and rethink it, because you may find yourself disagreeing with me now and agreeing with me later on. All right, we will continue with this section of recursion on Thursday.